The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Are you looking to overrun your characters with a near-endless horde of undead?
Yes.
Or bandits, or rats, or whatever you want? How about pitting them against creatures from hell flooding out of a gateway? Well, join us today as we talk about how to run monster hordes in Dungeons & Dragons. And I want to preface this with, it's not the only way to do it, it's just the best way.
Did you dislocate your shoulder while you pat yourself on the back there?
Hello and welcome, heroes, to the Crit Academy. I am your host, Justin.
I'm your guest, Garvin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
I'm your co-host, Brandon.
We hope to inspire you with creative content that you can bring with you on your next D&D adventure. Now,
yay!
I want to take a moment to thank our Emerald patron, Garwin, for joining us. One of the benefits is not only a wonderful game ran by me for him and his friends, but also he gets to hang out with us on the show occasionally.
I'm sorry.
Turning out to be a pretty good game. We're locked in this decision that we just cannot figure out what we're going to do.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? You're welcome.
Yes, it is awesome.
So I'm really excited for this episode because I feel like, and really, really to make your adventurers get that moment of feeling awesome, yes, killing a lich or a big boss dragon is fun, but overcoming a horde of monsters is so much more enjoyable, and it really gives you that epic feeling, right? Yeah.
Especially if you can give them that pucker factor.
Oh, yes.
And especially when compared to some earlier editions, a lot of the martial classes aren't necessarily built for it by default in 5th.
Yes, and so the rules for it, it is worth noting that the Dungeon Master for 5e Chapter 8 does have details for handling mobs. I don't like it. Not only do I think it's oversimplified, I don't think it's fun.
Yeah.
That's just me. I don't know. Did you get a chance to look at that, Garwin?
Yeah, I've looked at it now and again, and I'm still to figure out how the fuck it actually works, because I just don't care enough to try.
I'm getting you. Said it's a table, right, for a d20 or something?
Yeah, it's you're basically just rolling success. It's
yeah.
It's good if you got nothing else, but it's like Wizards is just
it,
like...
But fuck when it, you I figured it. Through, I just... I don't care enough to properly read it.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You shouldn't have to read it 20 times to get it. But one of the benefits of the style we're going to talk about today is it really helps to keep combat going. And it really isn't – it doesn't add a lot of work. In fact, I think it lessens the work on the DM compared to some of the other strategies. And there is an episode we had talked about in the past of mass combat, which is talking about dealing with like massive wars, right? This is having a horde battle isn't really the same as a mass battle where you got two large armies going against each other, right?
Nope.
It's usually just the adventurers, maybe a couple other groups
versus a
being overrun, right?
Actually, I believe the mechanic we're going to be talking about today has also been used in another adventure I did that was for sailors on a boat.
Ooh, maybe you can use that as an example when we get in there. So
maybe.
So I really want to get into this. It's going to sound super simple and silly at first, but promise, stick with us. I promise by the end of it, you will be just as impressed at our awesomeness as we are, okay?
Matt, at this rate, you're going to need to see a chiropractor.
I'm telling you, I don't use my hands to pat myself on the back.
Yeah, chiropractor.
Look, if
funny.
This keeps going, your ego is going to outperform Matt's skill.
Alrighty then. But so let's get into it. What really separates a horde as in D&D as far as individual monsters?
Lots of them.
Okay, well, give me some examples. To see if we tackle these problems, we need to know what those are, right?
Instead of wandering into a tomb of a zombie or two, you wander to a graveyard and all the graves
pop up.
Now you got 20, 30 zombies coming at you. That's a horde to me.
All right, Garwin?
Well, you could also walk into a cave and before you know it, there are kobolds everywhere. And you're trapped.
Fucking kobolds.
And they're trapped in here. Don't forget those. Love
kobolds. Or a marauding band of orc raiders.
Ooh, that's a good one too. Mm. So there's
bigger girl mode like that.
My favorite.
So but what oh, yeah. So what makes a mass combat like that feel mass though? Is it the hail of arrows? The barrage of creatures grappling and trying to pin you to the ground and overrunning your character with like five of them on top of you? What is it actually gives it that unique horde feel? Is it I slay one and another one fills its place?
I think from the beginning it's the number of tokens you put on a field if you use a map.
Okay.
That will make players shoot themselves.
I would also say to a degree where you feel like you're going up against a large amount of enemies, but at the same time, you feel like you can do this.
Yep.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, that does.
My personal favorite is a simple method where you make the players feel like they're just a tiny portion of this actual battle.
Yes, that's what I was looking for. Because that's really hard to do in most circumstances without having 100 monsters. But if you have 100 monsters on the field, if they go before the players, the bounded accuracy system in 5e probably is going to kill that.
Yeah, I mean, that is the unfortunate method of a turn-based system. If 1,000 enemies go ahead of you, you're probably dead. When in reality, if the wizard had gone first, they would be dead.
Yes, and that's one of the things that I think really makes the current system difficult for that, right?
Yeah.
So
as is, yes.
So the question is there a solution where we can get this feel of slaying lots of monsters, destroying the group, and having it still feel like an ongoing power struggle in the game?
Well, there's multiple solutions, but we're going to be mainly focusing on one.
Yes. So we're gonna talk on three primary points today. But the first one I want to talk about is the swarm mechanic. Are you guys familiar with the swarm mechanic?
Uh-huh.
I've heard of it.
It is one of my favorites.
So we'll use the example for the rat where it says the swarm can occupy another creature's space and vice versa. And the swarm can move through any opening large enough for... I put two wagons. To represent a big horde, because you know you still want to have some sort of control there. I think for the rats it was an inch space or something.
Yep.
The swarm can't regain hit points or gain temporary hit points. That's it. That's all it provides.
I believe the reason they say inch space is because it's the amount of space a single individual of the horde can get through.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I like that. So here we have a solution to the problem of making it feel massive. So let's start with the gargantuan stat block, which is basically 20 by 20 or anything bigger, right?
Yeah.
So basically you're filling the entire area with these. We'll do 20 by 20 just for the sake of talking, right? So in this, that's a big square area, so 4x4? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the players can share that area, which means as the horde moves, it creates a kind of a overflow around the environment, right?
Yep.
Which makes it feel like a horde right out of the get-go because the characters are standing inside the quote-unquote monster. So for this one, we're going to take a really large monster, apply whatever CR rating we want, and give it the swarm feature, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now we've kind of handled the how do you make it really big. Now, in order for this to make it feel really back and forth, it's going to be hard to move in a crowd, right? So I think that means treating it as what?
Rough terrain?
Yeah, difficult terrain, right?
Yep.
So that gives you the feeling of bumping into monsters and everything. But you'll notice that also means moving within doesn't necessarily provoke op attacks.
No.
Now, for me, this is where it becomes easier to track as a dungeon master. Since we're not going to be triggering 20 op attacks, we don't got to worry about tracking all that stuff.
And even then, you don't necessarily have to use one big swarm. You can use one or two smaller swarms.
Yes, and actually I was going to touch on that later, but since you brought it up. So let's say you do a 50 by 50 and the mage fireballs the center. You can then shrink it into two separate smaller ones that need to recombine to become the big horde, or they just stay as smaller hordes. And the swarm feature does that. Additionally, swarm monsters, their damage output goes down as they lose hit points.
Yep.
So that's the other metric that we're going to use, right? As it loses hit points, it's going to do less damage. Because that's what you would expect, right? Garwin, do you have any thoughts on this?
I will admit, I do love the swarm mechanic, especially when it comes to like the tiny creatures. Because like when it comes to rats and whatnot, you can treat each hit point as an individual rat, for example.
Yeah.
You can do that same thing here, too.
It does get more muddy when it comes to these bigger hordes, when you have orcs and whatnot, you know? Because then it's like you need more health for like less individuals, effectively.
Yep.
But it really does bring a real fun image up when someone does, like, let's say, thirsty damage, and you have to describe how they kill thirsty rats.
Right.
Yeah.
Fire. Do you guys got anything on that?
A really big hammer.
A really big hammer.
So the second thing we want to touch on is the swarm, or in this case, the horde. A horde or the swarm mechanic has specific immunities, which I think fits the group vibe very well.
Yep.
They're immune to charmed, frightened, grappled, paralyzed, petrified. Basically, most things that'll affect like a single creature. So, you know, freezing one person in a battle of a horde isn't really going to be game-changing, right? So it kind of offsets that a little bit.
And the best part, too, is you can still try to cast a sense effect and say, yes, you froze Dennis. Good luck with his 29 friends.
Uncle Dennis! Come charging at you.
That does beg the question, what happens when a horde casts Mass Suggestion on another horde?
So one of the things that I talk about a little bit later is some of the rules for mass effects like that. And the goal is it depends, right? If it's like a mass effect ability, then maybe you split the horde like what we were talking earlier and get two smaller hordes. One smaller horde that's 10 by 10, another one that's 10 by 10. And now this one is under the charm effect. So you still feel like that effect was useful.
Yep.
Right? Mm. So, and that's a real simple solution to that. Is it going to target the exact amount? No, but that's not what you're going for, right? You're going for ease of mechanic and flavor, right?
Yep.
Now, if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty of every single one, then you need to be tracking all your monsters and everything, which is just obnoxious and boring and, for me, not fun because it just takes too long.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
And I do understand some people really enjoy that, and that's all right. For me, I'm much more of a theater of the mind person, and because of that, this works much better than having 1,000 tokens on the battlefield.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear Ian's thoughts on that, because I know he really likes all the token battles. Good. Would something like this be okay with you?
Yeah. I mean, and even then, like I said, you can break up the smaller hordes too, and you can... Which means there's multiple ways you can approach it, both visually and from a token standpoint.
Absolutely. So
it arguably can increase flexibility in some cases.
Yeah. Wizard Cadia says, you know, freezing multiple, you could bottleneck the horde in the crowd. So we talked about splitting the group. Yep. If you freeze the group in front and it splits, they have to now go around or something like that, right? And once again, we're using the stat block of one creature. We're just giving it a few different abilities to offset the fact that it needs to represent a horde.
And probably more hit points.
Well, and probably more hit points too, but even it depends on the CR too, because you don't necessarily need to do that. If you're fighting a group of three adventurers, you can make a horde that's a CR3. Just pick a CR3 stat block that's made to go against the group.
That's fair.
And you're going to offset the action economy by one of the other two tips we're going to talk about here in a second, which is lair actions and legendary actions.
Yep.
Because that's the advantage of a party against a single monster, right?
Yeah.
Is they have action economy. So we can easily offset that using lair and legendary actions and even reactions, right?
Yep.
So aside from the creatures being tied into, say, the swarm mechanic, as well as the immunity to a bunch of the other conditions, the third thing that swarms provide, and we touched on already, is the fact that they get progressively weaker as their hit point goes down. Now, this doesn't have to, and they all have a shared AC, right?
Yep.
So once again, that follows the picking one monster, the AC doesn't change. Though, you could make an argument for increasing the AC as there's less of them. Because then you can't hit them as easily because they're not... I mean, if you swing a giant sword in a crowd, you're probably going to hit a couple of them. But if you swing it at one, they're more likely to evade you, right? I mean, I wasn't going to mess with that, but I can see somebody wanting to do that.
Yeah, makes sense.
Okay. Or I could actually see like a damage modifier going down too, the more damage you do to the horde. There's lots of things you can do.
And actually, that's one of the things that we talk on here is about starting with a high die. If it's a D12, maybe when it gets down to 75%, it goes to a D10.
Yep.
50% down to a D8. And maybe you stop there, maybe even go lower.
I was just thinking like maybe just like a tie, just the damage modifier, not necessarily the die itself. Or you could,
fair enough.
Or this could also be a good argument to tie it into just doing average damage.
Yeah.
The less there are, the faster they are. Because they're not tripping over each other anymore.
Ooh, I like that. Maybe you start them off slower, too. Darwin, what are your thoughts?
Honestly, I like those ideas you're all coming up with.
It's true, we're great.
And an idea I've been playing with in my mind is a situational multi-attack feature.
Mm-hmm.
Where it depends on the amount of squares that are in range of your players.
Well, if you're standing in the middle of the horde, you should have options.
I believe they call it a target-rich environment.
Right, because that's the idea, right? If it's a horde, you're sharing a square. So ideally, all around you is targets, right? People with the multi-attack are still going to benefit from the multi-attack.
No, I'm talking about the horde having the multi-attack. Like the horde only has as many multi-attacks as it has squares within range of a player.
That's fair.
Yes, but if it's also up swarmed to over point. Top of four players, it can attack whichever ones it wants as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I added up to a point.
Yeah. So there on some situations you're going to have to find a balance there. But once again, if it's a CR3, let's talk about the veteran stat block. It gets three attacks. So you got a CR3 horde that is, let's say, gargantuan. Let's do 30x30. And you reflavor them as zombies. Maybe you give it the undead horde feature, right? And have fun with that, right?
You could even limit it to, like, let's say, 2 or 3 attacks per player at maximum.
Yep.
That would also bring in the whole danger of trying to avoid being in the center of the horde, because that's when, like, all the things can properly hit all your players.
Yes, and so for me, the horde would try to, like, swarm over all of them.
Ooh, this is one possible option, but you could probably give it a engulf feature, similar to...
Yes.
Jolana's cubes.
Yeah, I definitely. The cubes or the shambling mound, I think they all have that.
Yeah.
That's perfectly acceptable, I think.
Oh. Yeah.
That's kind of like the fun thing about this horde feature. There's lots of options you could do.
Give it to an undead horde. Have that whole shambling mass coming for you. You just get automatically grappled as they overwhelm you.
Yep, shambling mound.
So we've talked about some pretty key features. You just mentioned adding monster traits. I think that's how you make your horde stand out. So the difference between a CR3 veteran and just calling them a bunch of guards is as simple as making them undead and giving them undead fortitude, right?
Yep.
So for me, that's just flavor at that point, right?
Yep.
You still get three attacks, so instead of two long swords and a short sword, it's three punches and a kick, or three headbutts and a punch, whatever you decide.
What if it's like it's a horde of zombies, right? But you give it an aura, like a necrotic aura. You take necrotic damage because it smells so bad.
Oh, that's nice. I think there's an ability for that on the troglodyte, actually.
Yes.
You know, actually, I think it should be poison damage.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's a lot you can do adding that flavor and that feel of whatever horde you're trying to go for. And it's not hard, really, to be honest. Next thing is it's important to include the fact that the horde probably isn't wielding all the same weapon. So unlike the veteran stat block that's basically all slashing damage, you can substitute it for slashing, bludgeoning, and piercing at will, and just describe, the bandit comes up with a giant, table cue and beats you at the side of the head with it, you take bludgeoning damage. Or the thug comes up with a broken bottle and, tries to stab you with it, you take piercing damage. That is a way to then differentiate the attacks from the horde, right?
Yep.
Even if you're attacking the same person, if they're standing in the middle of the horde swarm, everyone around him is trying to attack him. Yes, you're going to lose the attack of opportunity mechanic. I don't think that's necessary when we get into the legendary actions.
Side note, I'm actually surprised you haven't given hordes advantage on grappling checks. Just saying.
So when I had run this, I've run this three times so far, and I've really enjoyed how it's turned out. And I really wanted to, but I didn't want the hordes to
be too ridiculous.
So the fact that they're already immune to grapple and can grapple you already seem like quite a bit of an advantage, right?
Well, just because just multiple guys trying to grab you.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that I understand.
Yeah.
All right, so the other thing we want to touch on is the fact that we want to give our horde monster, legendary actions. The reason for this is simple.
There's lots of guys.
There's lots of enemies. So having technically one monster stat block... you're going to have a concern with, say, action economy.
Yep. Ooh, good question, Wizard Gideous. How would you handle a horde of ranged attacks or mixed attacks of fighters and archers?
All right, so you're getting ahead of me, but this is where I feel lair actions and legendary actions come into play.
Sure.
So you treat those as those special conditions. So maybe there's a couple wizards in there, and maybe there's archers. You could say that all archers and stuff are on queue, are scattered throughout the horde, and are releasing bolts, right? And those damages can go down as the monster loses its hit points, just like the rest. So you say, I'm going after the archers, you release a fireball, right? Boom, you make attack, it brings it down to 75%. Now there's less archers, less monster damage overall.
Something I think you could do too with a horde of range attacks is, instead of having like be a straight range attack, make it like an area effect. Like, I've seen people do that before with like columns of archers firing.
Yep, and that's kind of what the some of the lair actions can be, right?
Yeah.
Because it can just be, okay, there are, you know, a contingent of archers. The horde does 1d12, you know, piercing damage. On a make a deck save. If you succeed, you take, you know, half damage.
Yep.
And then as you weaken the entire horde, that damage gets down, because maybe they're running out of arrows and they're having to pick up weapons. Maybe somebody's getting blown up. That all comes down to the narration, I think.
Yep. Or they're chucking javelins.
Or they're chucking javelins, right?
How would you handle ranged attackers in the horde? Not all players.
They better try to run out of the horde.
Well, what about he says it's like a 20x20 horde. What if they're aiming at something on this side of the horde? Does it still
say you would follow the rules, don't you think?
I would say you're attacking the horde, so whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you would still be attacking at disadvantage though, because the assumption is you're surrounded.
Yep.
So drawing a bow, but that's where abilities such as fly or climbing to a high height to get out of the horde is necessary. What do you think?
If you have a climb speed, could you climb on top of the horde?
I could see an argument for that. After the wizard mounts one in the player assets, actually, the wizard just blew up a whole entire little segment of them. There's a mound of bodies to get you 10 feet high.
Hide behind the pile of dead bards.
What do you think, Darwin?
Roll a good enough acrobatics, and I'm not allowed to run over their heads.
I like that.
So what was that Xbox game with the mall and the zombies? Is it Dead Rising?
Yeah.
Where you can crowd surf the zombies?
Is this sad when we said, like, the mall? My first thought was, like, the giant hammer.
All right. So the other thing I want to touch on is legendary actions. The legendary actions are what can separate your horde a little bit. So if your horde of bandits has a priest or a acolyte or a mage or warlock or something, instead of treating them as individual monsters, those become the legendary actions, right?
Yep.
And you have a group of them, right? So... I would never say they got one wizard. No, they've got a couple wizards throughout the horde, and they've got, you know, a couple healers throughout the horde. So that becomes part of the legendary action list.
Yep.
And becomes the standard for it. And when maybe they lose some of those at some point once they get to a certain level. So at 50%, they've lost all their spellcasters. At 25%, no more healers. Or at 75%, no more healers.
Yep.
That does bring up a question. What about when players specifically target those elements?
So, what I did was, okay, I want to target this. And the first thing that came up was counterspell. Well, that was easy. I just canceled the legendary action. That was rewarding to them. When they decided to attack those, it came down to reducing the frequency that I used them. So, legendary actions, for instance, you're supposed to be able to get recharged every round, right? So when somebody attacked it, I treated it like a breath ability, where it had to recharge at that point, showing that there was less people using that power.
I also could see, though, that you could use it as argument, though, as the more uniform you keep, like, each person in the horde the better. And you can probably have like, let's say like have like the mage who were part of the horde, instead of being part of the horde, be its own like one guy.
That you could do that. You could do that.
I'm just saying that's one option.
Yeah. And there's a lot of options, right? You can separate out the hordes however you want, but the goal is to simplify the process as much as possible. And so to do that, if you're going to try to go out and single out every single monster, you might as well just be running all. Instead, you try to take what they want to do and figure out how it can reduce the effectiveness of the horde of what they're doing. So for me, for the counterspell, for instance, was, okay, if you're wasting a spell slot on that, it cancels one legendary action. I move on. They don't take a fireball.
Yeah.
And that was just the simplest solution to me. So one of the lair actions, I'm a big fan of taking content that already exists and just changing it.
Yeah, that's usually real simple.
For the lair action, I found a monster that had one that was similar. The Dalt White Dragon has a lair action that does jagged ice spears, right? So I just said, okay, it's not ice spears, now it's arrows. And it targets up to 3 targets. So if you got 5 players, you're only going to be able to hit 3 of them every top of the initiative. But it still gives that horde feeling, right?
Yeah.
Where the barrage of arrows are just coming in. Dex Stave works too, I think. So.
Yeah, no, I've been thinking, just in having healers within the hordes.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I had mentioned in the beginning that the hordes can't gain healing or temporary hit points.
So that's the special condition. That's a condition of a swarm. They can't gain powers or healing under normal conditions, and they can't gain temporary hit points. That's just the feature of a swarm. If I was to include those in my horde, I would just ignore that rule.
Huh. All right. Yeah.
I mean, or make it half as effective. With the swarm, the assumption is that every hit point is a specific creature. If you wanted to, technically speaking, if you want to heal that, you'd have to use resurrection or necromancy.
Yep. Yep.
Huh. I've also known in past editions too, I've seen like with like swarm creatures, they'll take like half damage on individual attacks, but double damage on like area effect abilities. Mm-hmm.
Which I personally house rule as an effect.
Yeah.
Well, so actually I haven't got to it yet because you're jumping ahead of me, but so part
it's a huge lot of information.
I know it is. So before we get to what he just touched on, because that's something that I had to come up with during when I was using it. So that, of course, is in here. But the other thing for the last mechanic I want to talk about is, the legendary actions. We delved into it a little bit.
Yeah.
But there's something that I really think benefits the legendary action in a horde with commanders. Using a legendary action to command the horde to dodge, for instance. To command the horde to shift and move on turns that's not its turn, right?
Yep.
And because it's a big giant swath, it may or may not move in or out around the players. And that brings up a whole new aspect of having commander ran hordes.
Yep.
Like soldiers or bandits.
Yep.
Or cultists, right? And so that it's not just that your legendary actions need to be attacks. They can be defensive in nature. It could be, as Brandon was just pointing out, thought they couldn't heal. One of them could be a command to heal. And then somebody might say, oh, I spot a healer. I'm going to counterspell it and then end the effect that they're supposed to benefit they're supposed to gain.
You could also, like, in a situation where your players want to target specific elements to, like, shut those down, you could ahead of time decide that, like, they have like 3 wizards to commander or something, and then just ask the player specifically to target those. Go like, these take like 2-3 hits to take down unless they do this kind of damage.
So I just use legendary resistance for that.
Yep.
Honestly, it was simpler, and I just reflavored the legendary resistance to fit the theme. Like one instance, the player said, hey, I want to attack the commander. So instead of just saying it's got legendary resistance, it's usually, 2 or 3 of them. Somebody jumped in front of the loosed arrows and took the blow for the commander. That was the legendary resistance. He was pissed off about that. I was like, he was a good commander.
I've never seen a mechanic piss off so many players in my life.
What's that?
Legendary resistance?
Yes, because nobody describes it.
Yeah.
if you don't say it's legendary resistance and just describe how they cancel or stop or save or whatever, it doesn't matter. You're never gonna. It's when you say those words and they knew they had no chance of success at all. It's really heartbreaking. That's why I think it's the worst designed mechanic in the game, because they don't give you anything. You think this should just be able to auto succeed?
Nothing really feels worse for a player than when you give it your all, you roll real high, and then the DM just says no and doesn't explain anything.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think I want to take back exactly what I said. I don't think the mechanics is designed poorly. I think that there's not enough presentation of how it should be handled.
Yeah.
Is that a little better?
Yes.
Okay. Because a lot of people say just that, oh, it's legendary resistance, you're boned. And they're like, oh my God, how many of those are there? Because now they know in their mind that there's going to be more.
Yep.
And that's frustrating.
Though for the strategic type of players, it does make it a little fun for them, where it goes like, okay, so we need to burn through these resistances, so we gotta use these lower tier spells to hopefully trigger them before we go to the higher ones, and then this little puzzle thinking and talking is real fun.
Yeah.
But that's a specific type of player.
So, as Ian so eagerly jumped ahead of me, beyond just building of the mechanics, there's an important thing as a dungeon master to be flexible, especially when you have players that want to do certain things. He just mentioned, if I'm going to fire a fireball into a horde, I'm probably going to hit a lot of people.
Yep.
So then that just becomes a vulnerability.
Yep.
Until it gets to a certain point. The fewer the hit points they have, the less monsters, the less effective the AoE is. So the AoE starts off as one of the more powerful. Then it becomes maybe at 75%, it becomes standard. So they don't get any bonuses. It just weakens the target. And then maybe at half, they have advantage on the saves, or it does half damage or something like that.
Or just keep it simple. And once they hit like a half health, they lose the vulnerability.
There you go. See, so you can really control that.
There's also a really key rule for that functions for almost everything in D&D. Don't be bound by what you write down.
Yes, absolutely.
If the situation seems like it, you know, seems to fit, just run with it.
Yeah. And you can change that as necessary, too. For instance, one of the ones I had ran was a mix of soldiers and a summoner summoning, like, magmans, I think it was.
Yep.
Well, now, they don't all have fire resistance, so the monster, quote unquote, the horde had fire resistance, still half health, and then it went down to just normal damage.
Just out there.
Of course, at that point, most people weren't using fire anymore, so it didn't matter.
Yeah. Thanks for the magman reference thing that you had a few weeks ago. I ran that in a game, and it popped my players. Because he was surrounded by them.
Oh, yeah. And they can chain each other.
That's exactly what happened. It went bam, 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 bam.
Yeah, well, it's like, you got to be careful. They're immune to fire, so.
Yeah.
When they detonate, they blow fire.
I might own a player apology.
That's funny. Oops. But still, that's a lot of explosions around him, too. Anyways. And you want to take that into consideration regardless of the power that they have, right? Mm-hmm. And that, like, one, I think, time they had hypnotic gaze. And I was like, oh, crap. How am I going to handle this? Because I think it was it's not hypnotic gaze. It lets them get a bunch of them at once. It's one of the warlock features.
Hypnotic pattern.
And I was like, shh, what am I going to do? And I did it. I didn't use sleep. Or sleep. But to his point, I was like, okay, well, now there is a 10x10 square of these things just, you know, standing there.
It's a hypnotic pattern. I think of a warlock pulling out this like little disc with a thing.
Fidget spinner. overall, what do you guys think of this style of combat of running hordes? And is this something you would try doing?
It's a good option.
It's something I absolutely would try doing, because there's a lot of this kind of stuff going on in the world I'm doing. I did have a question about, though, is
ask.
Once a horde is starting to get really low on its HP or whatever, does it split into smaller people who now join in to the initiative? Like, now you have two guys and you have this other guy who's going over with this other horde and he's helping them out.
So
I'll probably just keep the same initiative.
Yeah, so I wouldn't change the initiative, but one thing he mentioned earlier I want to talk about is oozes. One of the oozes, they split when they get certain hit points. So you could just have that mechanic planned out ahead of time.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, he's talking about just making it as something part of the game, but you can make it at 75, they split into three smaller, and at 50, they're two of them. The other one's kind of mix, you know? So
yep.
it's certainly a simpler mechanic that exists within the game that we can leverage to make the game run smoother and still get that epic boss battle horde feel.
Yeah. Oh god.
And that seems, Silver Wolf pretty much says the same thing. He thinks it's an easier option than from the mechanic standpoint.
Like, something I like doing with swarms is, like, for example, when players go down two separate hallways, one plans to basically use ranged attack on the horde when they go after this one particular target. I then remember, wait, these are like hundreds of rats. The swarms are going to split.
Really?
Yep.
I split it by hit points, effectively.
Yeah. And obviously, I think this is a good way to handle hordes, and especially if you can put multiple horde tokens on the battlefield. Yep. Now, as we discussed beforehand, though, that's not the only way you can do it. There's lots of things you can do. Like, there's like the minion mechanic, where basically all the enemies have 1 HP. Or, if you do something like that, you can just do average damage, which just speeds things up.
Yep.
You can, instead of like rolling for attacks, just say, okay, this is their attack modifier, you add +1 for every main attacking the players. Yep.
That's a good way to do it. That's one of my favorite mechanics in 4E.
Yeah.
I think minions are amazing, and I'm sure it's not going to be long before 5E brings them in.
5.5 or Anniversary Edition, or whatever they're going to call it.
I'm watching. All right, does anybody got any other further details on this topic before we move on?
Yes, but we don't have so much time.
Yeah, just to keep in mind that, you know, living things don't like to be hurt, and there's a reason why pikes worked, and why they probably wouldn't work in an undead scenario.
So, it's funny you talk about that. I'm going to make this really quick. I was running this theory with, damn it, Brandon, with bandits. And the bandits, they have morale. They're not all willing to die for their leader. So when I was running the horde and it got down to 25%, I rolled the commander's charisma check versus the insight of the group or morale. And I'm like, oh, that section just ran away. I just took away like a quarter of the monster's hit points.
Yeah.
Yep. As describing them fleeing. So that's certainly something that you can do as well when they know it's going bad. Run away!
Yeah, like, I definitely feel like key is to make sure that not every single horde you run, it goes through the whole lot. Swarm them like they're all undead hordes. Yeah. Like, hey, Benny, keep in mind what kind of creatures you're using.
Side of the river.
All right, that'll do it for our main topic today, how to run monster hordes in D&D.
Yeet.
Before we move on to our Unearth Tips and Tricks segment.
All right, Dungeons & Dragons fans, I'm going to be honest, I can't always find time for Dungeons & Dragons, and when I can't, I like to jump on some of my favorite video games. If you're anything like me, you hate playing with random toxic teammates. It really just ruins our fun, doesn't it? What if there was a platform that could help you find gamers exactly like you? I want to introduce you to our today's sponsor, eBlitz, the perfect social looking for group app for gamers of all levels. And trust me, I really range all levels. Helping you meet and match with like-minded, non-toxic gamers to play your favorite games in seconds. Once again, if you're anything like me, I don't get much time to play games. So when I do, I don't want to be steamrolled by some cursing punk. eBlitz allows you to simply start swiping to match with other gamers who share your similar interests, be it games, platform of choice, country, etc. Grow your buddy network with every single match you play so that you have a list of gamers to connect with and play with whenever you want them, giving you a better gaming experience. No more dealing with toxic players that just ruin it for everyone. You can download it today for free off the App Store and Google Play Store. You can find links in the description or visit rebrand.ly/eblitzgoogle or rebrand.ly/eblitzapple.
We...
Give me money, give me money.
Fair enough. We have released our Gambler, a new 5e martial class with three subclasses known as Gambling Circles. If you're looking for something fun and new, I highly recommend you check this out. It's a lot of fun. It has a very unique dice mechanic called Gamble, surprise, where you throw 2d6, and depending on what it rolls, it gives you different benefits. For instance, if you use your bonus action to gamble and you roll 2 sixes, giving you a 12, you're a high roller, which means your next melee attack within a minute is an automatic crit on a hit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Now, how many combinations in with 2d6s can you get to get?
1 out of 36.
One.
One. Just one combination, right?
Yeah.
You're saying percentage, right?
Well, no, it's a 1 out of 36 if you're rolling
cheese
side dice.
Oh, yeah, you're right, only one. and so that also means that that's one of the more potent ones.
Yeah, like roulette.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, let's just say I definitely know what the percentages are of 2d6 because I played so much HeroClix over the years.
Yeah. And then, of course, the more average one, like Lucky 7s, if you roll 7, which is statistically the most high, it allows you to get temporary hit points equal to your gambler level plus your proficiency bonus. So it scales with your character and is used enough. I think your gamble dice recharges on a short rest. So yep. It's a very fun mechanic. We had some really great feedback. If this sounds, obviously, who doesn't love running or throwing poker chips or dice or cards at their enemy? That becomes your kind of primary weapon, and you can change in and out of melee and ranged.
I'm nothing but the butler from Hunter Hunter.
Yes.
Be sure to stock up on decks.
Be cutting people. Yes. So, one of
Ahsoka from Hunter Hunter.
Yes. Yes. Ahsoka's probably closer. It's a lot of fun. Each one focuses on something a little different. We have Hot Streak.
Yep.
Which actually infuses it with magic a la Gambit style, right?
Yep.
Though he uses force, not fire, but whatever.
Yep.
And then the other two are totally focused. One's focused high on damage output. The other one's on, you know, a little bit more information gathering.
Should have added a mechanic called tilting.
You mean cheating?
No, tilting.
What's tilting?
Tilting is when you're doing good in poker and you just start losing every single hand.
Oh.
And you should recognize, oh, I'm losing, I should stop. You should have been like, oh, if you jack up 3 times in a row, then like, this benefit happens.
Let's talk about the gambles, snake eyes.
Hey, you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them.
Yep, there it is. You got to know when to hold them. I don't know the rest of the song or care, honestly. anyway, so if you roll snake eyes, you get an unfortunate debuff that lasts for a round. It's only a round, but like all attacks on you have advantage and you have disadvantage on all saves. It's horrible.
Now I'm just imagining some poor fella going snake eyes, snake eyes, snake eyes, snake
well,
eyes.
Well, so there is a mechanic that lets you change one of the die. So, anyways, please consider checking out The Gambler. It's out now. You can head on over to rebrand.ly/D&D Gambler. Pick it up. We love it. Support us. You help.
It's a good class. I watched Justin play it the other day, and it looks fun.
It's so much fun. My character's name was Punchline, and I had a lot of them.
I definitely love controlled chaos the most in D&D.
Yeah, right.
Not gonna lie, me and Trey at our table are going, how haven't we killed his character yet? are you guys part of the same party? Yes, and?
I don't see if that has anything to do with it. You can only handle so many puns before you're ready to throw yourself off the edge, or at the very least, punish the person. So, that'll do it for that. Let's move on to our honor tips and tricks.
And now, what you've all been waiting for, our Unearthed Tips and Tricks segment, where we bring you new and reusable material for both players and DMs.
All right, I am really excited today to talk to you guys about the Gaja Warrior.
I thought it was Gaha.
No.
I'm going to go get me
so
some.
So what is a Gaja Warrior? It is a elephant man warrior. Because Loxodon is already taken and copyrighted.
Yeah.
So I had to come up with something else. Here we got the Gaja Warrior. In order to build it, we're going to start with the Minotaur stat block. I'm really excited. This is obviously elephants are huge. They have powerful trunk. They have powerful build, right?
Yep.
That makes them really strong, which doubles their carry capacity, which is perfect. Yep. They also have trampling charge, which allows them to gain significant bonuses. When they charge 20 feet, specifically when they hit a target, they can knock it prone if they fail a strength save, which is really great.
And they get multi-attack with their great axes.
Oh, yes. Swing it. But if they knock a target down with their charging trample, they can literally give them the boot stomp or the hoof stomp. I don't think elephant men, giant elephant men can wear boots, but they give them the hoof stomp, right? Yes. What was that? I think I broke his skull. Of course, we're going to also top it off with a reaction. So when a creature scores a critical hit against a Gaja, it can use its reaction to release a deafening thunderclap from its trunk that echoes out to 500 feet, deafening and dealing thunder damage to the target. It's awesome. The art is beautiful. What would you guys do with something like this?
Man, getting hit by that sonic damage from that trunk, you just got to pack it up afterwards.
I would make this a temple guardian.
A temple guardian? Why?
Because it looks like it's made for tanking.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, what about you, Garwin?
Stay out.
Well, considering the name, I'd make him a bounty hunter, and every time he trampled his target down, he'd yell, "Gotcha!"
That's glorious. Gotcha. That is way... Gotcha.
Gaja is Malé for elephant.
Yeah, I know.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it wasn't an accident. I picked the name.
Apparently he was also a military leader.
So I really like this. I like a monster that focuses on charging and running and stampeding. The fact that we're able to leverage the big trunk and give it a kind of a thunderous, you know, boom is really great.
I'm surprised it has grapple.
It can grapple. It doesn't need to have an ability.
Yeah, I just thought about knowing you. It's like, oh, I love creatures that stampede and run people over and all this stuff. Yeah, you like grapple too, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I like to grapple people with this trunk. But anyways, if you like this and you want to check out the full stat block, you can check out our blog. Or if you want to get all the artwork, a beautiful backstory, and details, please consider becoming a patron where all our patrons get it. Garwin can probably attest to the quality of the material there, hopefully in a good light.
Yeah, I definitely can. I may or may not have stolen a few things.
Well, is it really stolen if I'm sending it to you?
I mean...
All right, that'll do it for our monster. Our next thing is our encounter of the podcast, which has been brought to us by our special guest, Garwin. Would you like to tell us about the mad orc?
It's an orc.
Of course it's an orc. I don't really think he knows that there's more monsters. And I think his monster manual is just orcs. Like, oh, hey, look at this lich. Look at this.
I created my own special monster manual. It's only 2 pages. It's just the orc section.
Tell us about the mad orc there, Garwin.
Gnome druids.
The party has been told to investigate rumors of a mad orc wandering an ancient battlefield. There's evidence he's preparing some ritual at one of the mass graves there. While no one is sure what, they're convinced it's for evil. Yorick actually has no ill intentions, and he simply wishes to fulfill his dream of being an elephant herder. If left alone, Yorick will start herding 100 skelephants from battlefield to battlefield and clean up the mess by having them graze there. As the party comes upon the scene, Yorick has started his ritual. A maelstrom of necrotic energy is beginning to gather over the mass grave, and he carefully harnesses it into the bones, his face scrunched up in concentration. Yorick is flanked by 2 huge skelephants, Bill and Billy, with include Barding, AC-16. That provides full cover to the skeletal cargo, protecting them from attacks from outside the ribs. Bill carries 4 skeletons armed with pikes, and Billy carries 4 armed with longbows. If attacked, Yorick will focus on the ritual while Bill and Billy protect him. At the start of each round, roll a DC-14 wisdom save for Yorick. If he fails, he gets distracted by the battle, and bolts of necrotic energy strike out at random creatures. Have everyone roll a DC-15 dex save, or take 2d8 necrotic damage on a hit. Undead get healed by the damage they take. Every 5 rounds, Yorick is uninterrupted, a skeleton rises from the grave, and wanders off in a random direction unless attacked. Then he joins the fray.
Yeah. Ooh. Okay, now I make...
Thanks, bye.
I'd just like to say, if you change the Minotaur stat block with the Skeletal Minotaur, you now have a Skeletal Gaja Warrior. Thank you, Garwin, for that. I love this encounter very, very much. Anytime there's a complex ritual or something going on in the background that the players have to deal with aside from just slaying monsters, that's always fun to me.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I especially love the fact that this, the entire scenario, is like when you players walk upon it, it seems like the classical necromancer doing evil got to attack it immediately, no questions asked. Right. When if they had just stopped to ask, it would have just been over. No battle needed.
Right.
I think what gets me the most is the whole, if he gets distracted, the players get hit.
Yeah, yeah. That's a huge thing that I don't usually do, and I like that. Because then he loses control of the energy, and it just kind of goes everywhere. But it attacks both sides.
Yeah, like, I really want to bring in the fact that he had no ill intentions. He doesn't want to hurt anybody, and the only damage being done is the player's fault.
Yeah.
Damn it, Billy! Stop attacking Billy!
Now, what was he doing there? He wanted to be a herder or something?
He just wants to collect elephant skeletons and make them into, like, a herd. That he can...
Yeah. Oh, he wanted to be an elephant herder, but elephants don't live where he is, and he doesn't know how to actually herd them, so he just starts in necromancy because he is a genius of the art.
That's funny.
And mixed skeletons.
I love the mix of necromancy and good intentions.
I'm now thinking about how a lot of historians speculate where Cyclopses came from is because, like, ancient Greeks, like, found, like mastodon skeletons, but never seen an elephant, so they didn't know what they look like, so they assemble them in a humanoid shape, and certainly, like, there's, like, a huge hole where the trunk is on the skull. They're like, oh, well, it must be an eye.
Ah, intelligence.
Well, to be fair, I've never seen one before.
Yeah. We're limited by the knowledge we actually possess.
And the more know, the more you realize you don't know.
Right. All right, I love the encounter. Thanks so much for bringing it to the table, Garwin. Ian, would you like to tell us about our magical item today?
Happily. Our magical item today is the Crackling Great Maul. It is a legendary weapon that requires attunement. You gain +1 to attack and damage rolls made with this weapon. Fuck? Its size for a giant, it weighs 300 pounds, and it deals 3d10 bludgeoning damage on a hit, plus an extra 2d12 bludgeoning damage to creatures at least one size smaller than you. The maul sheds green light as a torch when dragons are within 1 mile. The light can't be shut off due to this condition. And as an action, you can cast a version of the Scorching Ray spell that deals lightning damage to fire. Once this power is used, you cannot use it again until next dawn. Now, I can think of a few characters that... player characters that can use this, not just giants, which I'm assuming this is what it's made for, given the fact that, well, giants hate dragons.
That's true.
Because I could easily see, like a Goliath wielding this, or a fighter who took the room fighter archetype. Mm-hmm. They can make themselves bigger.
Yeah, I was just saying, is there anything other than a Goliath that could carry this thing?
Locks it on. Anyone with powerful builds can carry it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Interesting restriction, huh?
Yeah,
because it doesn't say it's only for Goliaths. It just has a strength restriction, which means people that have the enhanced strength spell cast on them, for instance,
or enlarged person. But that's what I
meant. What did I say?
Not that. Anyway, and the Rune Knight too can make themselves bigger, take up more spaces, so they could qualify for this.
Yep, yep.
And note how this is a legendary item. So in theory, this should be a high level.
Yes,
item.
Also, if a character that doesn't have the powerful build or any of the other things has 20 strength and they wear nothing else and wield nothing else and carry nothing else, they can wield it.
Oh, nice.
Their carry capacity is exactly 300.
So if you're really dedicated, you can do it. But clearly it's designed for creatures that have the powerful build that allows them to push, pull, and lift or double their strength, whatever it is.
Or Goliath Barbarians. Actually, this would be great for barbarians because their damage doesn't really scale once they get set extra attack.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's technically anyone who can do a
naked warrior.
Enhanced ability. using the bear, allows them to carry twice as much of their weight.
Yeah.
Something.
I like that.
So, it just makes me think it was an Elden Ring character carrying that big ass hammer around.
I'm just imagining a naked dwarf going into a dungeon, dragging this behind him.
Yeah. I actually like the aspect too that your average character can wield this, but you have to pay for it, if that makes any sense. And given the extra damage this thing can do, I'm okay with that.
You're talking about, like, the disadvantage on attack rolls?
No, I mean, like, you have to cast spells on a character for them to use it.
Oh, yeah. And that was the intent behind it, right? It wasn't...
Which actually forces party synergy.
Which I'm a fan of.
Yes.
So, I also like the Scorching Ray that deals lightning damage.
Anyway. Yep.
It's always fun.
All right, that'll do it for our magic item. Our Dungeon Master tip. Brandon, would you like to tell us about it?
Better monster knowledge checks. When it comes to sharing knowledge with the players about monsters, we as GMs typically choose some sort of intelligence check. Yeah. Or just directly inform the players with what their characters know.
Right.
And can sometimes feel a bit bland or binary during the game. If we consider knowledge checks to be more of a range band, we can significantly increase the narrative of monster knowledge as it pertains to the player characters. In a fantasy world, substitution and misinformation is common. Those damn stegosauruses.
Games of telephone.
That's an inside
Those
joke.
Those damn cursed stegosauruses. And don't forget the gnome
they
druids.
They misidentified...
Basilisks.
Basilisks.
It is a weird stegosaurus.
Now I remember one time I was misidentified Liz as kobolds when the GM described it.
This is particularly true over long distances. Details, rumors, and understanding of monsters also changes between groups. For instance, commoners likely have less understanding and information than merchants who travel, or nobles who have guards and aren't put into situations where they must engage directly with monsters. We know adventurers are certainly more informed on monsters than most, but that doesn't mean they know everything about a monster's skills, weapon techniques, weaknesses, strategy, etc. So how do we capture this variation with a knowledge check? Well, instead of setting a single DC, such as a DC 15 intelligence arcana check to learn what knowledge a character knows about mephits, in this case, if they fail, they may only learn that a mephit is an elemental creature.
So much information.
But a success may reveal the mephit is a magma mephit from the elemental plane of fire and can breathe fire.
Okay.
Yes, I could not realize that this fire creature to do fire.
That mephit's on fire. I bet it blows ice. I broke your tip already.
That's beautiful.
If we look at monster knowledge checks as a range band instead of just a success or a fail, we can expand how much knowledge is known based on the value. If we set the range from 5 to 30, we can make a knowledge check progressive.
Yeah, like a negative under a 5 on the check, maybe they just heard of the creature, and any information it identifies is outright misleading.
Fuck you.
Oh, must be an ogre. This will be a troll.
It's definitely a troll. See how it's looking at you?
Oh, God.
Maybe under a 10, the characters know some rumors. Some of it is inaccurate, but there is some ideas behind it, right?
Yep.
I heard that there's a great lizard folk warrior in this cave, little kobold called Steve.
I think a great example of that would be like, oh, there's a pirate with a hook hand. And you're looking for a pirate this whole time with a hook for a hand, when in actuality, it's a captain with a tattoo of a hook on his hand.
Oh, I love that. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Also, what the heck? Solar methods, weak fire, and forensic audits will prove it.
Forensic audits.
Anyway, so a 15 or less can accurately identify the creature, as well as some of its iconic features and traits.
Yep. It's a red dragon. It breathes fire.
Yeah, that's a good start, right? It can fly, too.
Yeah.
And maybe it can speak. Oh, my God. The players at church that I ran the game for, when they ran into a dragon, they freaked out when they realized it could talk.
What?
Like, they thought they were hunting a beast.
Yep.
Until it outsmarted them and then spoke to them. They're like, it talks! They're like, I don't want to kill it now.
They can talk? New plan.
It never occurred to me that they didn't have any...
Prior experience
with it. Yeah. Anyways, yeah.
It really throws you for a loop when you suddenly realize, wait, this thing talks. It has a soul. It might have a family.
So I had a
gold one of them. One is not evil. Yeah. And then it just kind of like befriends them. It's like, I thought dragons were bad. It's like, no, not all of them are.
Maybe slaps around one of the douche players because there's definitely one of those. At under a 20, the character is well-educated. On the creature, its features, traits, and perhaps immunities and resistances. At a 25 or lower, and I keep saying lower, obviously it's a range, right? I didn't explain that very well as we were talking.
20 to 25.
So it's 20 to 25, right? So the character has advanced understanding of the creature's culture, history, features, traits, and even weaknesses.
Ooh, that's important.
And then at a 25 to 30, right, the range should include even unique creatures.
25 to 30, you dissected it in high school. You know everything there is to know about it.
Well, it's more than just anything about a dragon, but maybe specific dragons.
Yep.
Right? Like, do you guys know a dragon's name?
A dragon's Smog. Name?
Smog, right? Ildrich, so you know everything about Smog, specifically, and red dragons in general, right? So, overall, what do you guys think?
Yep.
I like this idea.
I definitely like the idea, yeah.
I do, too. And I think this actually does, I think, help drive home the point where we kind of touched on this on the topic of metagaming a little bit, but one of my favorite YouTubers, Seth Skorkowski, I like it when he said one time in one of his podcasts, okay, if you tell the players it's a troll, don't be shocked if they treat it like it's a troll. Now, if you describe it as a huge hulking humanoid, then you have something to work with.
Yes, because then there's a lot of range in between there, right?
Yep.
I deal with the...
And I'm just saying that can remind me of that, because if you start off as like, you just know it's a huge hulking humanoid, that could be several things. It could be, so...
Mm-hmm. Could be a Goliath, could be a giant, could be a gnome on stilts.
And it also brings up other issues where, like, like, let's say from the player's perspective, you're told it's a troll, but your character doesn't know it's a troll. And then when you cut it, it heals. Like, you as a player really want to use acid or something, and you know that you might have figured out to use acid or fire, but now it looks like metagaming if you do.
Yeah.
Yep. Hence the comment, if you tell the players it's a troll, don't be surprised to treat it like a troll.
It's a swamp troll. Yeah. Mm. Turns out it's only acid stops it from regenerating, not fire.
Yeah.
All right, so that'll do it for our Dungeon Master tip. Our player tip is, don't be a dick.
By being a dick.
All right, today we're going to talk about the best rogue build, the ultimate shooter.
That sounds like being a dick to me.
It does. The core of the rogue's damage, we all know, comes from sneak attack, right? The feature itself is pretty powerful, but it does require specific conditions to achieve. Would you agree?
Yep.
Yeah.
Did you know that there's an option that they can take in Tasha's called steady aim that can ensure they get it every time?
Yep.
No. What?
Yep. Yep.
Steady aim basically says...
What did you think I was using in your game, Brandon?
cheating.
No, so steady aim's restriction is pretty obvious, though.
Yep.
You can't move.
Yeah.
Can't move before or after.
Oh, yeah. Think, that's right. Okay. Yeah.
That's a big limitation.
Yep.
But getting advantage and in triggering your sneak attack every time, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
But we still can't move. So what can we do to make this better, Ian?
It's better if you're a sniper.
Why? Basically, take a page from the Mongol horse archers and get yourself a mount.
Ooh. That's bullshit.
Yes, because
that's finding
what?
A loophole. So you're not moving on a horse.
You're not moving. The horse is moving, right?
Yeah.
But how can a rogue get access to this?
They can buy one.
Well, they could certainly buy one.
They could steal one. They're rogues.
I didn't even think about that. Mm. I got a little fancy to ensuring it, because that still has DM fiat, right? DM may not present the opportunity to buy one.
Yeah, but it does get to a point that where it becomes BS, depending on where you're at.
There's horses everywhere, but some people don't want to give up their horses, especially like small farm villages, right?
Yeah.
I mean, anyway, so let's say...
You're a rogue. You steal it.
Yeah, let's say that
I'm saying if you're in Waterdeep, you better have a freaking good reason why you can't buy a horse.
Yeah, but not everyone has that, so we need to have a way to cover this, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, fortunately, have you ever heard of the Ritual Caster feat?
Yeah.
Yes.
It allows you to basically learn pretty much any ritual that you can find access to, right?
I should pick. Oh, come on.
So, wizards, guess what's on their spell list?
Phantom Steed.
The Phantom Steed
that
spell.
That means if you're inside, you can still pop a horse in front of you. That's such... Okay. Yeah.
It's like Link using Epona's... the Ocarina playing Epona's song. Just shows right up for you. So, once you learn that, they can cast it, and it summons a spectral horse with 200... You can move up to 200 feet per round. because the horse's dash action is not your action.
It makes you think of Pokemon when you try to use the bike in a place you can't. So there's a time and a place for everything. This isn't the time.
For the place.
And this is also cool because, first of all, you're fast as hell. The enemy can't catch you. Sonic's even going to have trouble catching you. You can dart around from a distance, popping shots, add advantage, trigger and sneak attack, and just giving him the middle archer finger the entire time.
I do want to point out, too, that your mount does count as an ally, so even if you're in melee.
Yep. That's brutal.
Yep. Sorry,
I didn't even think about that.
Yep. Your mount also counts as an ally.
So if you don't use steady aim, you draw two weapons, you get advantage on both those attacks. You trigger that sneak attack, too.
Yeah.
So, anyways. Fun? No fun?
I think it's fun.
Power gamers, you're welcome.
Oh, it's definitely an idea.
Min-maxers, you're welcome. Role players, you're welcome.
Yep.
Because who isn't going to want
I
a little
will stick pack? With my favorite rogue build.
What's that?
My favorite rogue build, the Tabaxi Swashbuckler.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. Like, you run in, bash them, run out. Next turn, steady aim. Turn after, run in, run out.
I mean, if you use their racial feature, they can't move the next turn anyway. So, yeah.
So, what does it matter? Yeah. That's a good combo.
Yeah.
Bonus tip for everyone.
It's like they synergize, actually.
I love that. All right. I think that'll do it for our players of the podcast.
Don't be a dick.
All right. That'll do it for our show today. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a lot of fun today. I love today's topic. If you don't know, we will be going to, we'll be visiting GooseCon in September
30th.
30th. Please join us there. We will also be going to Grand Con, where we will have a booth selling some of our fat loots. You can see some of it here. What day is that?
Labor Day weekend.
She's got it up there. I still can't read it. It's too small.
Okay,
Labor Day weekend, though.
And just text over it.
Yeah, there's errors over it on my screen. So anyway, so please, if you're in the area, come and hang out. Come do some games with us. We'll be running games and stuff at GooseCon. What's the other one? Grand Con?
Yeah.
So please come hang out with us. Kick it with us. We'll get some pictures. I'll even sign something for you.
Oh, it has a value.
Well, it may not have value, but it sure made me feel good.
No. I said it will have the value.
Oh, someday. Oh, it'll have. All right. We just got another opening for our co-host on the show if you're in the Michigan area. So. All right. I think that'll do it for our show today. If you want to support us, visit CritAcademy.com. Check out our gambler, all our fat loots. Follow us on social media. That'll do it for our show today. I am your host, Justin.
I'm your guest, Garvin.
I'm your co-host, Ian.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon. Thanks for listening.
Keep your blades sharp and spells prepared, heroes.
You all right?
No, I just sat on my balls.
Don't do that.